You are Locked On Raptors, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hey, how's it going? Welcome to episode number 328 of Locked On Raptors for Saturday, May 5th. I'm your host, Sean Woodley of LockedOnRaptors.com and RaptorsHQ.com. You can find me on Twitter, as always, at WoodleySean. Find the show at Locked On Raptors, where you can find links to every single episode. Of course, make sure you're checking out the Locked On Podcast Network, team-focused shows for all 30 NBA teams. Great local angles on all the biggest stories, all the series going on right now, all the teams dealing with off-season stuff and trade possibilities and free agent questions. If you're interested in a specific team, find the show that corresponds to that team and support the host. You can subscribe, rate, review to those shows, and also Locked On Raptors on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, all the places where you find your podcasts. And it's very much appreciated if you just leave a little note and some stars. It's helpful, it's free to do, and it very much helps with iTunes' algorithms or whatever the hell. So thank you so much in advance for doing that. And let's get to the show. On today's show, I'm joined by one of the only noble Cavs writers, I think. We've had Justin Rowan on the show far too many times, so glad to get a reprieve from that with our friend Mike Zavagno from Fear the Sword. How's it going, man?
It's going well. How are you?
Been better, been worse. It's I think I've reached the acceptance stage of what's happening right now, and I just wrote today, actually, about LeBron and just sort of the crushing inevitability that he brings, and I've made my peace with it. So with that in mind, we're going to look ahead to tonight's game. Game 3 goes at 8:30 tonight in Cleveland. Raptors down 0-2, of course, after that disastrous Game 2 loss that we went into on yesterday's podcast. We're just going to kind of look at what maybe the Raptors can do, what the Cavs have been doing, and sort of try to gauge what's going to happen in Game 3 tonight. Mike, how are you feeling as like someone who follows and covers the team and is clearly a fan of the team? Like, is this something that you expected, that the Cavs were going to come out and just look this dominant? I mean, Game 1 wasn't dominant by any means. Maybe we should just leave it for Game 2 in terms of the dominance conversation. But did you expect the Cavs to come out and look this comfortable, this different from what they did in the first round?
To a degree, yes, and to a degree, no. I mean, I certainly wasn't expecting, all kinds of doom, heading into Game 3 with the Cavs being up 2-0. Mm-hmm. I thought they would probably look better in Game 2 than they did in Game 1 just because of the quick turnaround after the Pacers series. But, you know, the difference I think that I saw on film, most importantly, between Indiana and Toronto was just how wide open the games were going to be on offense. You know, Indiana, very physical team, switching everything, versus kind of Toronto's more drop scheme in the pick and roll, not really switching everything, didn't really have a guy that could kind of mirror what Thad Young was doing to Kevin Love. So I certainly expected a more offensive affair, but, you know, nothing like what we saw with the Cavs posting, you know, 140 offensive rating in Game 2.
Yeah, I mean, the Raptors' offense has been mostly fine so far. I mean, they shot 50-40-90 in Game 2 and still lost by 18. I think the defense is definitely where it kind of fell apart. And it is the defense, it's, I don't know, whatever mental barrier there might be there that you want to ascribe to the Raptors. And, like, honestly, at this point, I can't even fault them. Just with LeBron especially coming out in that second half, he had, like, 7, you know, turnaround 20-foot faders over OG Anunoby, and it's like, what the hell are you even supposed to do? LeBron said today, just, like, a little, half an hour ago or so, I guess, doing shoot-around, saying how, like, 2 points isn't just 2 points, and I totally agree. Those buckets completely deflated anything that the Raptors might have been able to sort of mount as a comeback in that game. I thought DeMar DeRozan did a good job late and sort of has done a good job for most of the series in attacking the rim and sort of being persistent and not just like getting passive when things go poorly, but there's only so much that can really carry you to. Let's get towards tonight's game. There was a little bit during Dwayne Casey's post-game press conference in Game 2. He was talking about Serge Ibaka and how poorly he's played. And he's been awful. He has been... Somehow, Eric Kareen from The Athletic just tweeted out that Ibaka has the best net rating on the Raptors in this series, which seems unbelievable. but I guess he's been out there for some of the better stretches. He got benched in the second half of Game 2. I don't know, sort of... He's kind of hamstringing everything, right? Because he was in theory, on paper, supposed to be part of a lot of the best lineups the Raptors could use to counteract when the Cavs go small. That's probably not going to be the case. If you're Dwayne Casey and you're looking at sort of how the roster is structured right now and who's playing well and who's not, and just sort of what the Cavs are throwing out there with that small starting five that they stuck with in Game 2, What do you do in terms of a lineup for tonight? Do you just stick with what's worked and sort of hope that maybe the game one, you know, run of things replicates itself where the Raptors were able to punish them not being super aggressive in getting Kevin Love open and Love missing some shots, and you know, they were able to sort of press the advantage of being huge against the Cavs? Or do you try to switch it up, go small, and sort of be more reactionary to what the Cavs did in game two?
Yeah, you know, I thought that I was actually looking at the same thing today with Ibaka and saw that he was only a minus three in the series. And I guess that it, you know, has to do with the fact that he was benched in that second half of game two before things could really get out of hand for him. But I was talking to Blake Murphy, too, about this, and I thought that one of the options that I think that the Raptors have that they haven't really shown much of yet is trying to go to Ananobi at the four and then playing three smalls. They tried to do it with CJ Miles, but you know, when you're keeping Miles out there and having him guard Kevin Love with, you know, see, there was a lot of it with just Siakam with Ananobi's foul trouble in the second half of game two, that I don't think that that's really a successful route. The Cavs have really taken advantage of Miles basically every time he's been on the floor. As soon as he comes in, he's immediately in the pick and roll with LeBron, and the Cavs know that they're not going to switch that, and if they do, that LeBron can go right downhill at him. He got an and-one in that way in game two, and I think that, you know, maybe you look at Fred VanVleet as that third guy. You know, you're not really concerned as much with the Cavs going big. As long as you can have Ananobi on LeBron and even, you know, Siakam or JV or Ibaka at the five on Kevin Love, you can pretty much deal with, you know, DeRozan on Korver maybe, and then, you know, Hill and Smith can be taken care of by VanVleet and Lowry. So that was a lineup that I thought might have some success. I think that you have to keep Ananobi on James as much as possible. He's really hurt Siakam a good degree in the first two games. But, you know, Ananobi looks like he can cover him better than anybody on the roster. So I think that some iteration of playing him at the four might be more successful.
Yeah, I think I'm with you. I think we saw a little bit of it in game two, maybe, but I can't really recall the exact lineups right now. But I think that makes some sense. Honestly, today I was kind of kicking around the idea because of how bad Love kind of burned Jonas in the last game. Like, there were a few examples where, like, Korver would set a pin down for Love, and, like, JV was just completely lost, unable to get out to the perimeter to even sort of feign a contest, and Love kind of ate that way. I almost wonder if maybe you go just, like, super-duper small. Maybe not to start, but if it's giving you problems, and if Jonas can't stick with JV, or stick with Love, maybe you just go Siakam at the five next to OG, and like, you're probably going to get torched on the boards, but maybe you don't. Like, OG's been a decent rebounder, especially in the playoffs. Siakam, I think, is kind of an underrated rebounder. He's not physical in the way JV is, but like, I feel like that might be a path to sort of opening up a bit more switchability on defense if you want to go that route. And also just like having your best defenders on the floor at all times is not a bad idea, especially if you're not going to sacrifice too much offense, which I know Jonas has been really good in this series, and I think he's a better playmaker on the short roll than say Siakam would be. But I think Siakam has some chops there. He's a pretty good passer. He's, you know, he's got a little push shot that has been pretty successful this season. I feel like there's some sort of room for him there to maybe operate a little bit, and maybe that mitigates his lack of shooting, because the Cavs don't really care when they stick him in the corner. But if he's making those plays on the short roll, maybe that utilizes his talent a little bit better. What do you think about that? Is that too small a look for the Raptors to throw at the Love at five look?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, part of what Indiana was able to do successfully against the Cavs was hide Miles Turner on J.R. Smith. But, you know, JV, I don't think, has kind of the athleticism and the weak side abilities to really succeed in that matchup. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when he is guarding Kevin Love, like you said, we've seen him really struggle with a lot of the pin down actions the Cavs are running on the weak side. You know, he's been switched on to Kyle Korver a few times, and Korver has gotten open threes. And so it makes it difficult for him to really have a place out there when, you know, Tristan Thompson or Jeff Green aren't on the floor defensively. And one of the ways, again, that Indiana was really successful is that they just mucked everything up. They were extremely physical, and you could see Siakam and OG kind of being able to fill those roles that Thad Young and Bogdanovich filled, being really physical and aggressive. Being able to switch that 4-5 pick and roll between LeBron and Love, and not really, you know, being too compromised. It's possible that you're giving up something offensively, for sure. I mean, the Cavs really haven't been guarding Siakam or OG on the offensive end to the most part. But I think that you've experimented with playing this wide open game for essentially the last four matchups, and it just really hasn't worked. I mean, you know, the Cavs just get open three after open three basically whenever they want. So if I'm Toronto, I think I'm going into this game trying to make it much more of a defensive struggle, really trying to be physical with the Cavs. If you can switch stuff defensively, I would be switching a lot. And I think that that is kind of the route that you need to take to better mess up some of this game than just trying to go shot for shot with the Cavs, because you just don't really have the shooters to be able to stick with LeBron and Korver and Love and Smith, etc.
How much has what the Raptors, I'm curious, because I didn't get to watch as much of the Cavs-Pacers series as I would have liked, because a lot of the games were happening the same days as Raptors games. But I watched it, and I don't know, I feel like a lot of the Cavs role guys were getting looks in that series, whether it was Love or JR or Korver or whoever. I feel like the similar sort of gravity that LeBron creates, as much as you try to stay true and only guard him one-on-one and stick to other shooters, eventually your temptations are going to sort of get the best of you and you're going to send extra help, and that's where he's going to pick you apart because he's LeBron James. But how big of a difference and how much different is this series and the Pacers series just because of the role guys hitting shots?
Yeah, I think it's definitely different. Obviously a lot of the role guys have really stepped up so far in this series in terms of their ability to hit shots from the outside. But I do think that a lot of it comes from a scheme difference. The Pacers really switch everything. They're able to basically have bodies, on the Cavs at all times. We've seen some of the guard-for-guard screens get Kyle Korver or J.R. Smith open threes in this series, and that was basically shut down because the Pacers would just switch that action a lot in the last series. And, I think that a lot of it just the drop scheme that the Raptors run is something that LeBron's consistently taken advantage of for, many years now, where if you're going to drop that big way back, it just gives him a lot of space to either find a shooter or, make a move at the rim. And he was really passive against it in game one. I thought that his legs were pretty tired, but he took advantage of it well in game two. And with the Pacers switching, I think that that just wasn't really an available option as much, especially for some of the other guys coming off screens. There just wasn't a lot of space on the floor, and everything felt really shrunken down.
Yeah, I thought you had a really good thread yesterday about sort of the comparisons between the Rockets and the Raptors and how they've kind of gone about building their teams in the face of this monster in their respective conferences. And though the Rockets kind of designed their team specifically tailored towards beating the Warriors, as you laid out. They switch everything. They have enough offensive firepower, in theory, to keep up with them. And whereas the Raptors, their defensive scheme, it works really well for the regular season. They were a great defensive team in the regular season. And I think, more importantly, it works for Jonas Valanciunas, who, in a more aggressive, high-hedging scheme in the past, he's been, just left out to dry and has not been able to sort of hang there. And I think this time around with this defense this season, we saw Jonas have his best defensive seasons. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's very much a product of the defensive system they ran. I don't even know what you do, because how do you sort of build a defense when some of your best players or some of the guys that you're sort of built on just aren't really conducive to playing that style of defense? And how do you trade off trying to be really good in the regular season versus building towards, this one opponent that you're almost certainly going to come across in the playoffs? And I don't know, I have a hard time because I really enjoyed this Raptors regular season, and I don't like sort of looking at it as though it was some sort of failure because they didn't, style themselves specifically to beat LeBron. But at the same time, maybe that is some sort of organizational failure where it says, you were really good and you were good enough to beat most of the teams, but the one that sort of tormented you the last couple of years, you couldn't design something to beat him. And at the same time, it's even if they did try to design a defensive scheme that could beat LeBron James, there's a good chance LeBron just beats it anyway and you lose regardless. So I don't know, that's such a hard thing for me to gauge. And I don't really have a question for you. I thought it was an interesting point that you made.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you look at this, the drop scheme essentially that the Raptors are playing, and you can draw some parallels to the Trailblazers Pelican series, mm-hmm. where the Pelicans, you know, shot 72% in the restricted area against Portland. Portland was the single best team defending the rim in the regular season, only giving up 55% shooting. You know, Toronto comes in number two, giving up 59% shooting at the rim in the regular season. So far through two games, the Cavs are shooting 67% at the rim in the series. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, You look at Nurkic and you look at JV as these guys who are huge bodies. You drop them back at the rim in the regular season. You force a lot of guys into more mid-range shots, more of those floaters. But you kind of get into the postseason and you face these athletic monsters, whether it's Anthony Davis, whether it's LeBron James. And, you know, a lot of that is kind of negated by their ability to just finish through contact and go through guys at the rim. And so I think that, you know, playing that drop scheme is a great way to protect guys like that and, you know, put them in a position to succeed. But when you look at some of these playoff matchups, it makes it more difficult to deal with these kind of, you know, singular athletic talents.
Yeah, I kind of wonder, and I think I talked about this on yesterday's show, for people who are listening and saying that I'm repeating myself. I do that all the time anyway. It's a daily show, man. I'm going to repeat myself. But I kind of wonder just like, you know, we made so much of how good the bench was this season and how, you know, the youth was so much further along than we would have expected. And I think you're kind of, maybe we underestimated just how much it takes to be ready to take on LeBron James in a series and sort of the refinement that you have to have as a defender. And I think we've seen with Jakob Poeltl, for example, he just has been lost defensively so far in these playoffs. And, you know, Pascal Siakam just doesn't have the strength to stay in front of LeBron as fast as he is and as good a job as he did on John Wall for spurts in the last series. John Wall is not LeBron. And, you know, even OG, he's made a few mistakes. He had a couple sort of hiccups that looked a little bit rookie-ish in game two as well, mostly on offense for him. But still, like, I think maybe we underestimated just how important it is to have guys who are seasoned and who know have faced the LeBron task before. I mean, it's nice to not be scared of him and sort of go into it being like, hey, we can beat this guy. We don't know any better. But maybe it is better to know better, if that makes any sense, if that's a proper use of English, to just like to know just everything about the guy and sort of have the experience of him destroying you to try to find ways to alter it. They're young, man. They're young dudes
who
3 or 4 years from now are probably more equipped for this, but maybe it's just we sort of projected too much upon them too soon.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, again, you know, if I'm Dwayne Casey and I'm looking at game three, I do like the idea that you tossed out there to play Siakam at the five, you know, OG at the four, maybe Van Vliet, DeRozan, Lowry in the backcourt, something like that. Mm-hmm. Just try to get physical, you know, try to switch almost everything as much as you possibly can. You know, obviously you don't want to get stuck with Lowry or Fred Van Vliet on LeBron in the post, but, you know, being able to switch that 4-5 action with Love and LeBron, you know, you can trust OG to handle Love in the post decently well, trust Siakam to kind of deal with LeBron on the perimeter. I think that that's really important when you're facing the Cavs. You know, you hope that OG and Siakam can be quite physical. And you just try to slow things down. I mean, the Cavs don't want to necessarily play that fast anyway. Mm-hmm. So if you can kind of make them run through actions by switching things and make them play later in the shot clock, I think that the Pacers had great success. There was a game in the first round where the Cavs took 16 shots when there are four or fewer seconds on the shot clock. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the type of defense that you want to play, as opposed to just kind of, you know, letting them operate in this wide open game where LeBron's basically picking and choosing what's going to happen on every offensive possession.
Yeah, he is a problem. Hot take, LeBron James is good at basketball. So looking ahead to game three tonight, I'm sure the Cavs are pretty heavy favorites. I don't have the numbers in front of me. Do you think there's any way the Raptors can pull one out here? Like, what would have to happen? What's the blueprint here for the Raptors to make this something of a series, even though we probably know that even if they win, it's not really going to be a series?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the first thing, just, you know, stronger commitment to making things harder on offense for the Cavs. I mean, if you look, like you said, at the top, the Raptors' offense has been great in this series. The Cavs switched a bit in the second half of game two. They were blitzing DeRozan. You know, I said before the series that was not going to be a successful strategy with how DeRozan has really matured as a passer this year. Mm-hmm. The Raptors scored 2 points per possession when the Cavs blitzed him. So clearly that was not a successful strategy. They went to a more traditional drop scheme in the second half of game two. I thought that worked much better. They had a 105 defensive rating in that second half. And, you know, I think that a lot of it was just them being able to kind of keep things in front of them a little bit better, funnel shots to the right shooters as opposed to DeRozan, you know, kind of being able to pass it immediately to the roll man and then them getting a wide open shot. We saw CJ Miles hit one in front of the Cavs bench early in that third quarter. And so I do think that there are some changes for the Raptors now that they know that the Cavs probably won't come out and blitz. The Cavs also stopped switching the DeRozan-Lowry actions, where DeRozan was really taking advantage of Hill in the post. And so I think that you just have to, you know, stay committed to your principles, know that the Cavs defense is much more likely to break down. You know, the longer that you kind of run through an offensive possession, the more actions that you have. I'd be interested in putting, you know, Kyle Lowry as the ball handler in the pick and roll a little bit more, as opposed to DeRozan, because I think that you trust him a little bit more to kind of put pressure on the defense with his pull-up jump shot, especially from three. If you're going to see the Cavs in kind of a deep drop scheme, especially with Kevin Love at the center, you might be able to take advantage of that. And, you know, just continue to run through actions, because the Cavs are more likely to defend for 12 seconds than they are for 24.
Yeah, the Lowry initiating a little bit more often has kind of been a thing I've been on about all year, but that's not really how they've played. But yeah, hopefully that's an adjustment they'll make. And, you know, it's a tough one, because having DeRozan work off ball is less, you know, dangerous than having Kyle Lowry work off ball. But I think in the interest of, like you said, maybe being able to take advantage of Kyle's shooting, which has been rock solid in this series.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's something you can do. Also, a plea to Ty Lue, please play Jordan Clarkson more. That would be nice. The Raptors will win if that happens. Mike, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that that's a change that Indiana made in the first round, too, is that they recognized that the Cavs were, you know, in their traditional coverage against Darren Collison in the pick and roll, as opposed to kind of changing their coverage to a more blitz-heavy scheme against Oladipo. And the Pacers essentially said, okay, we're going to take Oladipo, we're going to place him off the ball more, we're going to put the ball in Collison's hands, not because Collison's a better player, because we trust him more, but just because the Cavs are so much worse in their traditional pick-and-roll coverage than they were in that blitz. And so the Pacers really had some success by just giving Collison the ball and letting him operate in the pick-and-roll. And I think that, you know, that's something that can kind of be mirrored by Lowry here.
Yeah, good points all. Mike, you are much smarter than I, so glad I could have you on the show to break down what to expect from tonight's game. Where can people check out you and your work?
Just find me at MsVagno11 on Twitter. I'll be doing the film threads after the games, and then over at Fear the Sword, every once in a while, I'll find some time to write something as well.
Fantastic, man. If the series goes longer, which I don't know if it will, we'll have to have you on again. If not, enjoy watching LeBron kick the shit out of the Celtics or whoever it is in the next round.
All right. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Take it easy, man.